This is Guns in America, a special programme from the BBC World Service in association with American Public Media. I'm Mark Mardell. I've been the BBC's North America editor for 5 years now, and I've covered a huge variety of stories. But one runs like a drumbeat through my time here: gun violence. Only the worst, most horrific crimes make international news. The steady pulse of one dead or two leaves families destroyed, but they're quiet tragedies, unshared with the world. The three stories you're about to hear are snapshots of Americans and their complicated relationship with guns. They are intimate, everyday, and extraordinary. In my time in America, I've learnt changing gun laws here is immensely hard. Even after the shooting at Newtown, Connecticut, of those 20 little children and 6 adults at Christmas time in 2012, the politics of gun control made national policy change impossible, well, at least impractical. But I've come to understand why many Americans love their guns, and why they see any changes, even very modest ones, as an intrusion. This young country was seized from its original inhabitants at the sharp end of a Colt pistol and a Winchester rifle. They're part of this nation's story. And today America is filled with literally millions of citizens who own guns, who would never commit a violent crime, and feel it's their right, even their duty, to own a firearm. I think of the rancher in Montana who told me how he came home to find a bear climbing his porch. That man needed his gun. A coyote had taken a calf the previous night. His gun was a tool, like his saddle or his pickup truck. I think of a co-worker, gentle and politically liberal, who slept with a gun beside her bed. She believed the burglar, the home invader, would be armed. Why shouldn't she have a chance to come out of a fight alive? Their research says that gun is more likely to be turned on her. The cost of gun violence is often hidden or confused. One night in Chicago, I went with a police reporter to a fatal shooting on the South Side. Yellow tape cordoned off the area. The light of 2 police cars strobed the faces all around. We were told the dead man, his body in an alleyway covered by a blanket, was elderly. He went by the name of Pops. Someone there said they'd spent the afternoon with him. No one seemed particularly shocked. Indeed, in Chicago, more people are killed by guns than in car crashes. It turned out the elderly dead guy, Pops, was 38. This first story is about a community, about parenting, and about deep faith in other people. A study in 2010 by the Violence Policy Center estimated that, on average, more than 100 drive-by shootings occur in the USA every month, and each month they claim about 25 lives. And a 2012 University of California study found nearly a third of the victims of stray bullets are children. Charlotte Evans is a single mother in Denver, Colorado. Nearly 20 years ago, her family was mortally wounded by a stray bullet. But Charlotte refused to end the story there.
December 21st, 1995, was on a Thursday. Winter night, received a phone call from my niece saying there was a drive-by shooting down in the Park Hill area. This area, Park Hill, which is the gang Bloods, was their territory in a sense. She said, "Would you come and get us?" And so that evening, I went down myself, Kason, my 3-year-old son, Calvin, my 6-year-old son, and my boys were asleep in the back seat, and with my 17-year-old niece sitting in the back with them.
Charlotta parked in front and left her 2 sons sleeping in the car with her niece for what she thought would be just a few minutes. Then she walked inside the house to meet her other niece.
So I'm looking out the blinds, and she's showing me the bullet holes at the top of the ceiling and what came through the window. And the minute I stepped back from the window, we heard gunshots. Glass starts shattering. I got on the floor, not knowing really how long that we were on the floor. Everything's silent. And then my cousin in the car comes and runs in. She's like, Bunny, they shot up the car. But I'm not registering the fact that the car is being shot and the house. It never came to mind that my kids were in danger.
Charletta ran to the car to check on her sons. Calvin was visibly afraid, but otherwise fine. Kason looked like he was still asleep. But when Charletta's knees reached towards him in his child seat, she saw blood.
What I'm doing is trying to keep myself under control so we can remember where's the closest hospital. So I saw two people standing outside their home. I jumped out the car, went around the back and got Kason out. And he's still breathing. And I'm saying to him, come on, man, you could make it. You can make it, little guy. And he's still breathing. Mommy's right here. We go into the home, and he's laying on me, and he's breathing. And so I'm thinking, I'm still not aware of where he was shot. I had no idea. I remember that shortly the paramedics came, and they bust through the door. And right before they took Kason from me, he took his last breath in my arms. I knew that he had took his last breath. They knew he took his last breath. And I never forget, when I looked down on my clothing, my whole dress was covered in blood. From my collar to the hem, all the front of me. So he just bled out.
Charletta was plunged into grief and remembers feeling numb, wanting to hide from everyone. She didn't yet know who had shot her son. But just hours after Kason took his last breath, even before she could work up any real anger towards the killer, she felt called to another response, an unlikely, amazing response.
When I look back on the same night, getting a visitation at midnight from the Holy Spirit and giving me pretty much a question and a suggestion at the same time. Will you forgive? Have you considered forgiving? And will you? And I said, are you asking me to forgive? God, is that you? I felt his presence. And I said, yes, I'll forgive. And I was able to go lay down. But when I look back on that, that was the most essential beginning of my healing, forgiveness.
Three days after the incident, police found Raymond Johnson with the stolen gun. He was the one who'd pulled the trigger. He was 16, a kid from a nearby neighborhood eager to impress his gang, the Bloods. Within months, he stood trial and was sentenced to life at Lyman Correctional Facility outside of Denver. I tried to interview Raymond, and he seemed eager to tell his story. But he was worried about a rival gang hurting his family if he spoke, even after all these years, so he kept mostly quiet.
My name is Calvin Tyler Hurd, and I'm Charlotte Evans' firstborn son, and I am 25.
Calvin was 7 when those bullets rained on Charlotte's car, killing Kason. He doesn't remember the incident, and in fact, he doesn't remember all that much about Kason, except that he was a bright, rambunctious kid. But as the years passed, as Calvin grew up, the story of Kason's young killer, Raymond Johnson, did make a big impression on him. By the time Calvin was a teenager, he not only forgave Raymond, as his mother did, he even identified with him.
I had compassion toward him, and then knowing that he was doing well, and that he had turned to Islam, and really to be there and see that he was authentic and real about what he was doing made me accept him more. And so that's the reason why I accept him as being my brother, regardless of him taking mine. It's the same one for all these other guys out here. I accept them as being, just being me. They're the, you know, kid of the street.
We're talking about a 16-year-old kid that just got served a life sentence, that grew up a gang member pretty much, and that was what he was born into, gang life. He didn't know no different. So nothing registered to him till 1999, when he began to become a man and start looking at himself. And that's when I got the first letter.
The letter from Raymond arrived on Mother's Day. At first, Charletta couldn't get herself to read it, then couldn't get herself to reply. So her sister did for her.
And in this Mother's Day card, he addressed me as mother, which that's how they address women in Islam. But also he said, "Would you be my mother?" That instantly brought tears to my eyes, because what it did, it expressed a need and a want that he had, but then also who I am. You know, you took my son's life. So I'm warring with that. So my tears were tears of sorrow and joy, pretty much. Joy in the sense of what a good thought that would be to meet his need, but also my son's gone.
Raymond kept writing her. This went on back and forth for a few years, until Charletta decided she was ready to visit Raymond in prison. The young man in his late 20s facing her seemed all grown up and full of remorse. She could see it in his eyes.
But when it came to sitting down in that dialogue, I wanted Raymond to feel my pain. I wanted him to know my process, what I was absent of. And that's my son, Kason Xavier Evans. And this is what the effects of him not being here, what it did to us. And then be able to say to him, "I came here to tell you in your face, face to face, that I forgive you." And I told him, "So it's time now for you to rid yourself of the guilt. You have no reason anymore."
The meeting in prison proved healing for Charletta, and over time, she found herself starting to campaign for Raymond's resentencing and release. But while Charletta was advocating for a former gang member, her son Calvin was flirting with gang life. He was 14.
At first, it was kind of like, "Oh, this is not for me. I'll be fine. I'm just going to hang out with these guys and things like that." And then just one day, I decided just to get jumped in, and it's like, afterward, I knew that after that, I was kind of just like, I'm in, you know, just kicking it and just having fun. But I got older and older. It got to the point to where you're getting confronted by other gang members because of me wearing the bandana and different things like that. You're not really awake at that age. You're kind of just strictly instinct. Then when you become a gang member, I consider it as being more like a possession. If you're not used to it, it'll take over you and you'll sit there and you won't remember anything that happened. And then you'll pop up and you end up somewhere just like how Raymond ended up.
Didn't really know what was going on. I'm thinking, you know, he came home beat up, you know, to where I had to take him to the hospital. And so he's like, you know, "Well, these other rival gangs jumped on me. Like, I have nothing to do with that, but they jumped me on my way home." I was devastated. And at one point, I remember, because I had to take him to the hospital twice, I thought I was going to lose him to gang life. And when I looked in my son's face and told him, "What are you doing?" And to see that look on his face, like, this is what I'm doing and I'm not changing it, even though I'm in this hospital. That feeling, you don't want to ever feel that feeling, because you feel like you're losing your kid. You're not in touch with the kids, you know, anymore.
In When it came to handling guns and using them against other gang members, that's when Calvin decided to leave the gang, so he got jumped out. That's the term that gang members use for beating up someone who wants to leave the gang. But for Raymond Johnson, the worst happened before he could make that choice. He was 16 when he and two others stole a car and the gun that Raymond fired, killing 3-year-old Kason. One of the other kids in the car was Paul Littlejohn. He also went to prison for his involvement in the shooting.
My name is Joanne Lewis. Paul Littlejohn is my son. I'm his mother. Paul was 33. When the incident happened, he was just 15. So he's been down for 18 years. I always pray for Charlotte Evans. This woman, I lost her son. You know what I'm saying? I had to have God did in the mix. You know what I'm saying? Because don't nobody want to hear nothing when their baby's gone, you know? My son, he was taken away too, but I could still talk to him. But as I was praying for her, I was asking God to mend her heart and my heart, for I can ask her for forgiveness. And so I just prayed and prayed. It took me 11 years. Then one day I woke up and God, he just gave me a sign like, this is now.
Joanne called her sister Diane, asking for help. Diane's life had also been transformed by a gun. Her son was paralyzed after a shooting that killed his best friend. How could Joanne face Charletta and ask for forgiveness for her son? But it turned out that Diane and Charletta were already in touch. After her son's shooting, Diane had formed a church group for mothers touched by violence. Mothers like Joanne and Charletta and herself.
My name is Diane Cooks and I'm the director of FAVA, which is Families Against Violent Acts. Most of the time when there's a shooting and we know about it, we go to that family. Most of the families, we know. We know the family, we know the victim, and then we know, sometimes we know the accuser who died the shooting. So therefore, before we even go forth, we have to pray. God, lead and guide us. Tell us what we need to say and what we need to do. Charletta was one of the first mothers to come to the group when we were all here. But me and Charletta's friends, we go way back. And so, you know, we were really close. When that incident happened, oh my God, she shut down. And I was hurt because we found out that was my nephew. And she found out that was my nephew. That affected our friendship. So we didn't talk for each other for a while. But that woman, she came to me one day, Charletta, and told me, she said, I love you, Diane. And I said, I love you too, Charletta. And so she said, I'm sorry this happened. I said, yeah, I'm sorry this happened too. That part's very emotional for me. I said, I'm sorry that happened, because that really messed our relationship up. She didn't know how to respond to me, and I wanted to respond to her, but she was hurt.
By 2007, Diane and Charletta grew close again, and they would go on to welcome a growing number of local women whose sons were either victims or perpetrators of gun violence.
Yes, God.
And God, as she goes to and from, Lord God, we just speak a blessing upon her right now. In the name of Jesus. And for this, we thank you. Yes, God.
Standing around in a tight circle, holding the hands of other moms and with eyes closed, Diane prays for a new woman in the group. Faith is the only thing that gives these women hope, they say, the only thing that keeps them from falling apart.
Amen. All right, girl.
For Raymond Johnson, the young man who shot little Kason and is now serving a life prison sentence, prayer is a lifesaver. He's now in his 30s and a converted Muslim. Thanks to Charletta's efforts, he's expecting a resentencing soon, too. I wrote to Raymond at Lyman Correctional Facility, and in one of his replies, he wrote, I am forever grateful for Miss Evans and her son for forgiving me the way they did. Mother Charletta healed me in ways that I thought was impossible. For when she spoke, I heard and then seen the power, the wisdom, the mercy, and the love of God backing her.
Ruxandra Guidi with that report. You're listening to Guns in America on the BBC World Service. I'm Mark Mardell. More Americans die by suicide than by homicide each year, by about 3 to 1. In 2010, more than half of all suicides were committed with a firearm. Many Americans don't know this, because Americans, like many of us, don't talk much about suicide. The stigma's too great. And the United States government doesn't talk much about links between gun access and mental health. Only last year, President Obama lifted a 17-year-old freeze on gun violence research at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Whatever the statistics, suicide by gun is always a story in two parts: mental anguish and deadly force. Reporter Kelly Hardcastle-Jones tells the story of one man particularly close to her.
My friend Ian Anderson committed suicide. No one saw it coming.
Ian was definitely the type of guy who really enjoyed being a guy.
That's Monica D'Aguiar. She and Ian were engaged. Ian was a mason. He built walls, worked outside, and with his hands.
He always worked with his shirt off. He always had a 5 o'clock shadow. And then he was just like such a character. Like, even his accent was ridiculous.
Ian's accent was so ridiculous, even he made fun of it.
We're wicked smart.
I recorded Ian over Skype a few years back. He told me about Hurricane Irene, a storm that knocked out power for a week.
It's like fun for 2 days. And then when you have to get up and go to work, you're like, oh, there's no electricity running to the house. Stupid Irene.
He wants to swear so bad there.
Because we have an electric boiler, so can't cook
it. Ian drove a huge pickup truck, loved action movies, owned guns, and wasn't very forward about his feelings. And that especially became trouble. Because even though Ian was a really social guy, he kept some of the most important stuff secret. Like the fact that he suffered from a type of depression called dysthymia.
Which is basically, you're depressed all the time, and then when something happens, it's like double depression. So the coping mechanisms that usually work don't work. I mean, like, if we were to get into a fight, it was like, you're gonna leave me. And it was like, I'm not gonna leave you, we're just having an argument.
Ian coped by surrounding himself with friends.
He hid his depression really well. And even when he talked about it, it was almost inconceivable. Like, what do you mean you aren't happy? And so the depression didn't come out really until I found out about the drug abuse.
Ian and Monica had friends that abused prescription drugs, and she started to see the warning signs in Ian. Like, he would lie about what he did with his money. Then one day he fell asleep while driving. Monica was in the car. A few months later, Ian was hospitalized after an overdose.
I kind of gave him an ultimatum, like, I can't do this alone anymore. I can't help you by myself, so you have to tell other people. And so he told his mom, and he told Carl and Kenny.
Carl and Kenny Kreitz are brothers who grew up next door to Ian. They were some of Ian's closest friends.
We were brothers. I mean, friendship is not the term to use. He approached me once with something he was dealing with, but I didn't think it was depression. I thought it was more, you know, drug abuse.
That was Kenny. And this is Carl.
A guy like Ian doesn't say, I am depressed. He says, I've got stuff going on right now. I've got problems.
Ian told Carl and Kenny about his overdose, but he didn't reveal the depth of his addiction or depression. Even Monica didn't realize how bad it was. Until one night, when she called Ian to make plans after work.
He was obviously using something, and I got really angry because I thought everything was okay.
Monica hung up on him and regretted it immediately, so she called right back.
And I said, I was sorry. And at that point, he stopped talking to me. And he never did that. And I remember rushing home and just really getting worried because I just didn't know what I was going to come home to. I knew that it was bad when I went into our bedroom and We had a small safe in the closet.
That's where Ian kept one of his handguns, a .45 caliber Springfield XD.
But my shoes were everywhere, so it was obvious that he had gone in there. At that point, I knew it was really bad. I thought he was going to be dead.
Monica started calling friends and asking them to look for Ian. They checked houses, bars, old job sites. Rhode Island is small enough, you really can search for someone in a night, covering all the familiar places. But Ian's friends didn't call the authorities to ask for help. Monica was outnumbered by friends who thought that Ian was just letting off steam. So they didn't report Ian missing until the next morning.
I couldn't sleep. I didn't sleep all night. And the police came over, and I just remember specifically them asking me if he would ever hurt himself, and Kenny said no, and I said yes, because they didn't know he was that depressed.
Friends and family started gathering at the house, waiting for Ian to turn up. And then...
I don't know how I thought of it, but I was like, he might be in South Kingston. Kenny went down there. And then he came home and told his mom and I he was there.
Ian Anderson died on April 12th, 2012, from a self-inflicted gunshot wound at St. Francis Cemetery.
I, like, refused that to be the case until I saw him dead. It was only after the fact that I realized why Monica was so scared. I actually laugh at myself about how naive I was. You know, that morning I found him.
The next day, Monica asked Carl and Kenny to get the rest of Ian's guns out of the house.
I just needed them out. I didn't know where they went. I didn't want to know where they went. I didn't really care. I guess I almost hoped that I would never have to think about them again.
We kind of took it upon ourselves to make the bad thing disappear.
I ended up purchasing the firearms.
That made sense. Because Carl, Kenny, and Ian kept most of their target rifles and pistols in a safe they bought together. When they were kids, Carl and Kenny introduced Ian to shooting. The guns and the gun range weren't the focus of their relationship, but they were ways to stay connected.
I really didn't understand why they would want them. I still don't understand. Would I have preferred that I didn't know that they had them? Probably. I would have preferred that they had just sold them to a gun shop or given them to the police and have them destroyed.
How do I see those things? I don't know, they're just little embodiments of Ian. You know, I feel guilty sometimes that you lose sight and forget about your lost friend. Even if it's a friend who's not dead and somebody you lose track of, and then you're like, I haven't thought of that guy in a while. Well, it's like that when you lose your best bud. You know, a week goes by, a month goes by. You know, doing something like knocking the dust off the equipment is, that's good. It's going to be a reflective period and pay my respects to my boy.
Close that door behind you because the cat likes to get down here.
I asked Carl to show me their guns. Wow.
These are hunting rifles and target shooting rifles and pistols.
And is one of these Ian's gun?
Yeah, this is Ian's. Ian really liked this weapon. He picked it out, and he wanted a nice rifle that would shoot in .223 in that caliber. And he went with the Savage. It's a very nice weapon. It was well-maintained. It's out of the box, very accurate. It's definitely not a cheap rifle. This was his baby.
Carl and Kenny consider guns tools that need to be used.
I feel I'm responsible for being able to operate and understand a firearm. It's just part of, in my opinion, being a good American. I'm a man in this country. I should know how to use a firearm. For that in and of itself.
Just because you can.
And should.
So, a few rules to go over while we're walking in. So, very important.
Carl took me to Highland Rod and Gun Club, where Ian had a membership.
What do you got?
So everybody signs in on these bad boys.
We found Ian's name on the registration log.
Oh, there he is.
This is Ian and Kenny. 45-308-223. So he brought the Savage, he brought Kenny's XD and probably his XD, and a 308.
Wait a minute, is that January 7th?
January 7th, yeah.
That's today.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is. January 7th, 2012.
We were at the gun range exactly 2 years to the day since the last time Ian was there, completely by chance.
All right, let's get to it.
Carl and I both shot Ian's Savage 10, a .223 caliber rifle.
All right, Kel, come on.
Oh, is it my turn?
Yeah, it's your turn.
Okay.
Ooh. Squeeze that trigger, don't pull it.
You get all these walks of men that just are at the range and...
That's Kenny again, Carl's brother.
They're all generally pretty solid men. And by men, I'll just say, like, Americans. It just fit him. I don't know whether it was because he didn't have a father growing up, but I think he liked meeting and spending time with my dad or any man that he felt was a man.
Ian didn't know his dad. He died of a cocaine overdose when Ian was 2 years old. Ian's dad was never diagnosed with depression. But after Ian died, Carl started to make connections between them. Both Ian and his dad were troubled, secretive, and self-medicating.
Now knowing, you know, what we know now, yeah. I didn't realize, maybe some other people did, you know, how close Ian felt like he was mirroring his own story of his father.
Ian committed suicide next to his father's grave.
A couple of people had told me after the fact that he had spent time there, and I didn't even know that. I didn't know that that was his thing, to go there and talk to his father.
Vincent Vespia is the police chief of the city of South Kingstown, where Ian died. All of the gun applications come through him.
It takes a person to kill with a firearm. So, you know, our job is to identify people who should be disqualified from owning a firearm. Is that a difficult job? It's a terrible job.
The gun application is four yes or no questions. One is, have you ever been confined for a mental illness? If you say yes, you'll have to meet with Chief Vespia. But you won't have to give a detailed medical history. And there's no way for the police to confirm the status of your mental health, which can be a big problem.
I approved the purchase of a firearm. And the person who purchased the firearm murdered two children and herself. I was devastated over that. Very troubling even today. But I had no reason under the existing law to deny her the ability to purchase that firearm because I didn't have access to whatever mental health record is available.
So the other part of my piece is about the relationship between firearms and death by suicide.
Well, that's... I'm very familiar with that for a couple of reasons.
Which are?
Well, I've had a suicide in my family. I wouldn't talk about it on record. And of course, there's a very strong relationship between the two. If I could denote through a investigation or added information on a background check that somebody, you know, had a problem, I wouldn't authorize the sale of a gun, and maybe that might prevent a suicide.
A recent study from George Mason University found evidence that increased gun access leads to increases in gun suicides. In fact, more gun access leads to increases in overall suicides, not just suicide by firearm. The study found that reducing household gun ownership by 10 percentage points could mean almost 3,000 fewer suicides each year. Suicides by other means might increase, but overall suicides would drop. With statistics like that, it would be easy to blame the gun for Ian's suicide. But for Carl, it's not so simple.
Having him die by the gun does not mean that I have changed the way I feel about firearms. If Ian didn't have access to firearms, then there's a great possibility that it would have, the outcome would have been the same. How do I explain this? I don't feel guilty about the fact that I didn't deny him access to firearms. I feel guilty about denying access to his feelings, if you will.
Even Monica, who hates guns and wanted Ian's guns out of her house immediately, can't bring herself to blame the gun.
The guns were never an issue with the depression. I was worried about everything else. Everything else except for Ian hurting himself. I can't blame anybody. I can't blame the mental health institutions. I can't blame the guns, and I can't blame him. But I know that he felt a lot of shame. And if I could take one thing away, that would be it.
That story was produced by Kelly Hardcastle-Jones and Lou Olkowski. To hear a behind-the-scenes conversation between me and Kelly and all the producers in this hour-long special, go to bbcworldservice.com. You're listening to Guns in America on the BBC World Service. I'm Mark Mardell. I went to Newtown, Connecticut in 2012, just after the Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre there that stole the lives of 26 people. It was the row of Christmas trees that got to me, one for each murdered child, by the roadside, surrounded by candles and notes, some with their favourite toys at the foot. A year later, near the anniversary of the killings, I stood on a snowy hillside and watched the parents of those who died walk to a microphone and promised to remember their dead son or daughter by lighting a candle. The words didn't change much. The faces did, some in tears, some a rictus of grief, others stoic. That tragedy and that anniversary, each was reported around the world, but many similar, if smaller, killings go almost ignored by the wider world. In 2013, there were more than 30 school shootings across the United States. 3 days before Newtown, there was a different attack all the way across the nation in the northwestern state of Oregon. A young man there shot two people at the Clackamas Town Centre, a Portland shopping mall. Then he shot himself. Oregon filmmaker Skye Fitzgerald began a quest to understand the heated gun debate in Oregon following Newtown and that shooting at Clackamas Town Centre. He soon found opinions divided over gun control by geography. Cities are for restrictions, the countryside against. Fitzgerald worked with radio producer D. May Roberts on this story. They went back to Fitzgerald's hometown in eastern Oregon, where there's a population of under 150, to talk to people there about their relationship with guns.
I live about 3 miles from Clackamas Town Center. I first began taking my son there when he was still in a stroller. Here he is riding the merry-go-round inside the mall. The shooting at Clackamas, followed by Sandy Hook, got a lot of Americans thinking about guns, myself included. I thought I knew how I felt. I live in Portland, and though I own a gun, I think training should be required before you can buy one. And starting out on this project, I certainly didn't think the solution to school shootings was to put more guns in schools. But I knew people may feel differently in the tiny town where I grew up, a place where guns are a fact of life. I drove out to my hometown, Monument, Oregon. Monument sits on high desert ranch land smattered with juniper and sagebrush. There's a single store, a post office, and a school. My first stop is a visit with Mitch Mund, one of my first bosses as a teenager.
Hey, Mitch.
How are you?
Good. How are you, retired man?
Busy. I need a rest.
Mitch is a big guy with an unruly mustache. He's just retired as a regional forester. He's also a rancher.
We have about 440 acres. It's enough to go broke on. Living in a very rural setting like this, we have a very open society. Not many people lock their houses. You go downtown, you go to school, you go to the local store, and everybody leaves their keys in their car outside.
Mitch and I have known each other for over 25 years, but until recently, we had never once talked about guns.
I got in a little bit of trouble with my wife because I think I bought my boys 22s before they were big enough to hold them up in the air. Just because they were too heavy for them. I don't know. They were four or five, I'm guessing. I don't remember.
In Eastern Oregon, it's not uncommon for kids to learn to shoot with their parents' supervision as soon as they're big enough to safely hold a rifle.
That's the biggest thing is safety. And that's why I did it and started at a very young age, because they have to understand what that weapon is capable of doing and they have to respect it.
My co-producer Dime asked Mitch if he would load and fire one of his favorite weapons.
It's a revolver. This caliber, it's a 357 Magnum. This is also a single action revolver. So you can pull this is the hammer. And until that hammer is pulled back, it will not discharge. You always treat it like it is loaded.
I've always thought of Mitch as one of the most reasonable people I know. I also know he has strong feelings about guns and schools that differ from my own.
You look at Sandy Hook, what happened there, from what I understand, they are not allowed to have any weapons in school. Did that guy, I forget his name now, did he know that? May have. If he knew that people were able to pack a concealed weapon there, would that have been a deterrent? That's something that I would consider a deterrent. I think it's safe for Monument to do that, to have staff that would be able to do that.
About a third of schools in the U.S. have armed officers on site, and a similar percentage allow an adult with a gun permit to carry a firearm on campus. There's no evidence that arming schools makes them safer. At Columbine High School in Colorado in 1999, two teenage shooters killed 13 and wounded 24. And in 2007, a gunman killed 32 people and wounded 17 more at Virginia Tech University. In both cases, armed officers were on site.
I hate to see any type of shooting that's not warranted, and especially in a school. Will it continue to happen? Probably. Do I say it's never going to happen here? No, I do not believe that. It can happen anywhere to anyone at any time.
So Mitch and I agree that these school shootings are a tragedy and a national disgrace. The question is what to do. I'm curious what Mitch's wife Ginny will have to say, because she works at Monument School, a quick drive into town.
It almost looks like brick, but it's larger stones, painted sort of off-white, beige, with a nice green lawn spreading out in front and a nice welcoming set of steps. And a big sign that says, you know, welcome to our school, where every child counts.
I'm Jenny Mund, and we're in the Monument High School right now.
To me, Jenny Mund epitomizes small-town friendliness. She's been the school secretary for 19 years. She has short, light brown hair and an easy smile.
We have a very small library. We do have a bookmobile that comes in from the county library, and they come once a month. Guys! This is 5th through 8th grade PE right now.
There were 50 kids in the high school when I graduated. Now, there are 17. Ginny Mund thinks about the safety of every one of them.
I pray it never happens here. However, you never know. After Sandy Hook, I went and got my concealed weapons permit, and I don't carry yet, but it's coming soon, because if somebody comes in here and decides to go to shooting our kids, they're going to have to go through me. I just can't take that. It just won't happen. Last year, we had a man who has mental issues. He had a gun, and he was up very close to our ag building, which is on the north end of the campus up there. And it takes the police officers a long time to get here. I mean, we're at least an hour. We had a police officer come and tell us he could make it here in 40 minutes. I don't want to ride with him, but 40 minutes is good. But boy, he's flying. And you get used to that out here. It takes a while to get help. This is Maggie Messer Anderson, and this is Javier.
I'm Javier Iniguez. I'm a freshman.
I'm Maggie Anderson. I'm a sophomore. I don't think any of the kids here would even for a second think about bringing a gun to school.
I think that bigger schools, the only person that should would be the principal. Like, if anything happens and the police can't come. And if it's like a situation that would happen quickly, he would use it. But for other occasions, I think the police can handle it. I don't think the teachers should use the guns.
I think I'd feel a lot safer actually knowing that if someone walked through the door and was threatening to shoot someone, the teacher had something to go to, had something to help protect us, because that is what teachers, like, yeah, they teach us, but they also protect us in case anything like that happens. And I think having a gun would provide that.
My name is Earl Pettit. I'm the superintendent, principal, athletic director, bus driver, bus trainer, every administrative title for Monument School District. We have 5 teachers. We have 49 kids. That's pretty common for Eastern Oregon. We're not unusual at all. Our safety considerations are not constant concern. Our safety concerns are more like, you know, if there's going to be a stray dog come onto the campus, what to do when the cows are out in the football field and the kids are going out to play, you know, that have strayed into town, things like that.
But Pettit, too, says that something more sinister could happen at any time. And a security guard at his tiny school is not an option.
Do we want to employ a police officer when we can't afford a nurse, when we can't afford a librarian?
But there's nothing in school policy that prevents a teacher with a weapons permit from bringing a gun to school.
Our district has no policy for firearms, in particular, one way or the other. Meaning, if you have a concealed weapons permit and you want to exercise that right, there's nothing banning a staff member from carrying a concealed weapon. Now, at the same time, we don't say we promote the carrying of concealed weapons. I liken it to the way the military used to deal with gays in the military, and that is, don't ask, don't tell. There was a time last year, there was a student who had threatened to bring a gun, that had threatened to harm staff or our students. Never did, never materialized. And when all that was taking place, I'm going to guess that at that time when we had some elevated threat, there were probably a couple staff members that had weapons. And I can't disagree with that, because remember, it's 45 minutes for the police officer to get here. I mean, if we didn't have availability of weapons, and that scenario did play out here, we would be questioning afterwards why there was nobody armed.
Those against putting guns in schools raise a host of concerns. How do you safely store a weapon in a school? How do you make sure police don't mistake armed teachers for assailants, or that kids don't get caught in the crossfire? These arguments make sense to me. Before this trip, if you'd said the best way to protect students was to arm teachers, I would have laughed. And yet, the more I talked with people in Monument, the harder it became to see a better option for a school so far from law enforcement. For another perspective, I went to see State Senator Floyd Prezansky. For 2 decades, he's represented the district where Oregon's worst school shooting occurred. In 1998, a student in the town of Springfield shot his parents to death and then opened fire at Thurston High School, killing 2 students and wounding 25. Senator Prezansky chairs the Senate Judiciary Committee in Oregon and has been working on gun safety bills.
I've lived guns. I've had them in my life. I've had bad things happen in my life with guns. But at the same time, I'm not going to ever say no, that we should ban guns outright in our society.
Prezansky has owned guns his entire adult life. He also had a sister murdered with a firearm. I ask him what he thinks about allowing teachers in rural districts to be armed.
You need to allow for flexibility, and you can't just say one size fits all, and that's just how it's going to be. And I would really, really find it distasteful and very harsh if I lived in a smaller rural community and to hear that the state legislature is going to force us to do this or do that, where it doesn't fit in our community.
I've come around to thinking that arming school employees may be reasonable in some remote schools. But in other ways, our relaxed gun laws in the U.S. still don't make sense to me. In talking with Mitch Mund, my old boss that we heard earlier, I pointed out that there are fewer regulations for owning a gun in Oregon than for operating a car. I think that's crazy. But for someone like Mitch, it makes perfect sense. Because to him, driving is a privilege to be earned, while gun ownership is something more fundamental, a right that's guaranteed in the Constitution.
So yes, the rights that I have are very important to me. The privileges that I have are very important to me too. But I think there's a marked difference, and that's something that we just have to agree to disagree on.
But I'm not certain agreeing to disagree is good enough. I mean, look where it's gotten us. A long pattern of school shootings that doesn't seem to be slowing down.
There's a lot of dark things within American history. America hasn't been around that long compared to the rest of the world. We've been very successful as a country on a lot of fronts, but we've done other things very poorly. A child's life is very important to me, whether it's my own or somebody else's. That's our future of this country. And so we have to do things to the best of our ability to protect that.
As Americans, we just can't agree on how to protect our children.
What's all these?
Those are watermelons that fell down.
All the watermelons fell down.
If statistics hold true, in the next 15 minutes, 3 more people will be shot in the U.S. Somehow, we have to do better.
Goodbye, Sid, everyone. See you later. The end.
That piece was produced by Sky Fitzgerald and Dime Roberts. You can find links to more of their work at bbcworldservice.com. You've been listening to Guns in America with me, Mark Mardell, on the BBC World Service in association with American Public Media. You can see pictures and listen to these stories again at bbcworldservice.com. Let us know what you think. We're on Twitter at BBC World Service.